Hello, and thank you for listening to the new series, Series 2 of the Nurse Researcher Podcast. This series aims to chat to clinical academics and to really identify what their role entails, how the jobs are split, what they do in their daily life, and really what are the tips and what advice can they give to people aspiring to be a clinical academic. So give us a listen, share the podcast with others, press follow wherever you listen to or get your podcasts, and we hope you enjoy the episodes. Hello and welcome to this new episode of the Nurse Researcher Podcast, and I'm delighted today to say that we are joined by Roxanne Crosby-Nwobi from the Moorfield Eye Hospital. Roxanne, delighted to have you with us. Welcome aboard.
Thanks, Andrew. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I know that you've got many titles and many roles. So I've mentioned the Moorfield Eye Hospital. Perhaps you should tell us where else you work at the moment.
Thanks, Andrew. So I'm the lead nurse researcher at Moorfield Eye Hospital, and I'm also the interim program director for the NIHR Senior Research Leader Program.
Marvellous. And so valuable to have you here, and so important to hear your story. And I think this is one of the episodes I've been looking forward to the most. But before we get to where you are now, let's take you right back. You'll have listened to episodes. I know that you have. So let's take you right back to the beginning. So how did you become a nurse, and why did you become a nurse?
Yeah, a very interesting story. So my mom and my aunt and my sister are all nurses and health visitors. And back in the Caribbean, we just don't do adult nursing. We have to do absolutely everything. So my mom was a hospital nurse, but then she did community nursing, district nursing, health visiting. And then when we went to the remote areas, she was literally the be-all and end-all. So I remember in my childhood being taken on what we call a staycation in the UK, but it's literally a very remote region of Trinidad and Tobago. And she'll be the only nurse for a very, very large community. And there'll be a maternity unit attached to the nursing home. And I remember boiling water and, you know, running to and fro within the unit, helping her out while she was working. So it was a vacation for us, but it was actually work for her. So that's quite interesting. But from the age of 10, my mom gave me a book by Professor Ben Carson called Think Big, Unleashing Your Potential for Excellence. And he's a professor of neurosurgery at John Hopkins Hospital. And I was like, right, that's exactly what I want to do. Neurosurgery, the brain. If he can do it, I can do it. And then, you know, being a mom, and, you know, now we're thinking about where we say, oh, no, we help our elderly parents do things digital. My mom was the reverse. She's like, I'm feeding you, therefore you're going to help me produce all my quarterly reports for vaccinations and everything else. So having to draw histograms at such a young age and learn all that data, that really got me thinking about, you know, data, academia, how do you use graphs? How do you present things properly? Moved on quite swiftly. I went to the equivalent of a grammar school in the UK. It's called Holy Faith Convent. Got some good grades. Did A-levels in chemistry, physics, maths, and further maths of all things. And then thought I'll go and do medicine to go into this neurosurgery as I'd planned. But then when I approached the local university, they were charging a really exorbitant amount of money, and there wasn't a payment plan option. And I thought, I can't give this bill to my parents. So I said, thanks, but no thanks. And then came to the UK and got into the nursing program here at the University of Surrey.
Wow, that's probably a very unique start. I don't think we've heard that sort of story before. And for our listener that can't see what I can see, you have a sort of medical history as your wallpaper behind you. So what am I right in saying that you've been a bit of a student of health generally, that you've got a real passion for the history of it as well?
Definitely, definitely so. I enjoy reading about health, about, you know, medicine, nursing, food being your medicine for health. It's just always fascinated me. And then having my mom there as a constant role model, you couldn't get away from it, really.
Yeah. But that's a huge difference, isn't it, in career? Now, never once on any of these episodes have I played down nursing or the role of nursing. But from what your ambitions were to then coming into nursing, did that disappoint you? Was that a change of plan that you clearly hadn't planned for that? There was financial reasons behind it. But what was the feeling with you and your parents at the time? Had they aspired for you to be the neurosurgeon, the medic as well?
My parents, thankfully, never had any aspirations. They were always, be the best that you can be, and we will support you through it. The choice to become a med to do medicine or to become a doctor was my personal choice based on a book I had read. And I hadn't been exposed to anything else besides my mom being a nurse, but she was completely supportive. So no, there was no disappointment. It was a change in career. And then once I was, exposed to the theoretical side of nursing, because I'd lived through the practical side of nursing, it was like, yeah, okay, I've come home. This is where I was always meant to be. So there was no looking back, really.
Yeah. So when you qualified as a nurse, what did you specialize in? What became your passion from your nurse training?
So initially, I did my first placement on my first ward in gynecology, and I met a brilliant matron at the time, and she was proper old school matron. Her name was Barbara Doyle. Couldn't do without her. She took me through everything, and I'll give you a little short story. So when I walked on to my ward, first placement, what my mentor said to me, "You can't be Roxanne Crosby." And I'm like, "Well, why ever not?" And then she said, "Well, Crosby is a white Liverpool name, and you're obviously not." And that was my first exposure to nursing in the UK. And I was like, "Okay, whatever." I went to a convent, I don't need to listen to this, because it never occurred to me that, my name or my appearance, my color was a big problem. So fast forward 3 years, and I also had her as my third year final placement mentor on a gynecology ward. And another strange experience, it's weird how you remember all these things. She then We were on doing a night shift, and she said, "Oh, what's the name of the bank nurse we've got coming on this shift?" And she said, I told her what the name was. It was an African name. And she said, "Well, she can't be any good, can she?" And that stayed with me, and it's till now. And so even though I qualified in nursing, that experience shaped me and shaped my research and the way I interact with my colleagues and the mentorship and everything else that I do. Because if that's what I experience based on my background, what else is there that has gone on and other people face day to day that we need to be aware of?
And alongside your background, it's the negativity, isn't it? At the very early stage as well, the negativity around the message that you're given right from the start.
First year, first placement. And it just kind of things like, okay, fine, I'm not a Windrush generation, but the reason I was allowed to come into nursing is, so I'm a guest here, but I don't feel like a guest. I don't feel welcomed. Yeah,
Yeah, they're
I
very,
know.
very a difficult start. So how did that influence you then as a staff nurse? Where did you start and how did it change your outlook? Because I'm not going to jump ahead too quickly because that's influenced your research. But equally, what impact did that have on how you were as a nurse before we got into your research?
I think it opened my eyes quite a bit, because, as I said, I never understood or realized that my color could be could make it, could be a difference, or there was a problem with my color or anything. So, and just reflecting, when I was at University of Surrey, I mean, this just happened to be that in my 3 years of nursing, I'd never nursed a patient from a black or brown community or the global majority. So just fast forward, when I qualified for a year, got married at the age of 24, moved to a city where I then encountered patients from a global majority background. I literally and honestly, and this is an honest reflection, I had to call my mom to say, "Mom, how do I nurse an individual from this background?" Because I hadn't been trained in my 3 years, and I'd never actually learned it. So how do I recognize different signs? And that's when my eyes was further opened, as it's just not me being a society or me being from a nurse perspective, or just being about me. It's about me and my entire practice. What do I need to change in my entire practice and my outlook in terms of how I look after my patients, how I look after my colleagues? So my net just keep people and gotten wider and wider. It went from being about me to my patient, and then later on, their families and their community. So yeah, all these experiences shaped me, and I'm not unhappy that I had them.
No, well, absolutely, they've been the making of you. Perhaps that's what you're alluding to, I think. My next question usually is that first sense of knowing that research was for you. I mean, not many nurses would. There won't be many nurses in the UK that say, "Yeah, oh, I did further maths." You know, it's not something that nurses do on the whole. And when you speak to nurse as a nurse educated for many years, you always sort of, the nurses always say, you know, numeracy has been the difficulty, the maths, those sorts of things. So you were clearly naturally academic. What was the driver to push on? So did you qualify with a BSc or did you do a diploma? How did you start to think, actually, academia's for me, I'm going to do the next thing?
Yeah, I never actually thought about academia being for me. I just got bored. So did a degree at University of Surrey, and then, got married. Thought, okay, living a happily married life. Loved my husband, and then I thought, oh, I'm a bit bored now. What else do I do? So then went on and did a master's during on my annual leave because we weren't allowed study leave at that time. So I took my annual leave over 2 years and did my master's degree. And then I got bored within 6 months of having a master's, and I thought, okay, what's next? And I met this lovely lady called Irene Mabbutt, and she invited me to present at a local hospital conference. And then after I'd given my presentation about my master's project, she's like, right, you're going to do a PhD. And then and there, she wrote me a reference. And then I went to London to do a PhD with Professor Siva Prasad and Professor Angus Forbes.
And that's quite, I mean, that's a big jump, isn't it? That you qualified, you're doing a master's degree, you're doing a degree. What's the time span there? Over how long is that?
BSc to master's was about, I say, 3 years. Master's to PhD, 6 months.
Wow. So, but I mean, they clearly had great faith in you to do that and recognize that that was the right thing for you, because you've been really sort of guided along there to sort of do something that people can find extremely difficult, but it feels like the trajectory for you was really quite quick. How did you find your PhD? Was it bigger than you thought it would be? Was it the experience that you thought it would be?
I had no expectations of the PhD. I think what I was more concerned about was that I qualified in gynecology and urology, and I was doing a PhD in ophthalmology, total different end of the body. So I think my PhD was more about, okay, doing a deep dive into ophthalmic nursing, the maths bits, the bit about qualitative and quantitative. I can learn that anytime. Yeah, I can get that. But the ophthalmic and the clinical knowledge, that was the main thing. And then again, this message about our underserved communities came in quite stark when I started my PhD. I was doing recruitment, and my PhD was about looking at diabetic eye disease and the relationship to the brain. So I've gone full circle. I'm neurology again. And I had a patient chuck a slipper at me from an Afro-Caribbean background because she thought I had sold out to the white man. I was, one of them. And I quickly understood. I had to speak to her to ask, okay, well, why do you think this after I had to duck the slipper? And she was saying that around that time, the Metropolitan Police had developed this DNA database, and she erroneously thought that the blood samples we were taking would somehow be available to the police, and then they'll be able to trace her grandson who was involved in nefarious activities. And it's about, changing perceptions, changing myths, having that conversation, and bringing her along with me for the journey. So the PhD, the actual doing of it was fine. The learning about eyes and the population, and then going from myself to now the patient and now their family and the communities, and that span is what was really, really interesting.
It sounds like there was so much for you to consider. And so much, sort of spread of the focus to some extent, that there's a lot to take on board there with the work that you did. What was your PhD sort of question, and what was it that sort of what took you into that ophthalmology element of things?
There was an advertised PhD at King's College London and King's College Hospital. I had already been to that ward, so it was a natural progression into diabetic eye disease. And the cognitive impairment bit is because we know that the eye is linked to the brain, the blood-brain barrier, and the retina is all linked. And the main question was, we know the eyes are the windows to the soul. So can I look into your eyes and look at your blood vessels and the architecture of your blood vessels and predict brain activity or cognitive function. So that was quite interesting, actually. And
Yeah.
now we know, based on the team that I'm working with currently, brilliant younger researchers have found that by looking at retinal images, you can predict Parkinson's disease 7 years before the symptoms actually come
Yeah,
on. So,
yeah.
we were onto something at that stage.
Yeah, incredible work. And has that been really the, has that launched your not only your doctorate but your postdoctoral career? Is that did that then become your passion, ophthalmology?
Definitely. Still in the field, still love looking at people's eyes and giving advice because it's so essential. We know that 86% of our population thinks that their eye, their sense, their eyes, the mo and their vision is the most important of their senses. And if you lose that, people tend to lose a sense of self. So how can I, in my role, empower them to realize, okay, yes, you've lost your sight or you're losing your sight. However, these are the things that we can do for you:
Yeah.
psychological care, emotional care for you, your family, understanding the impact, the socioeconomic burden. And that's just for people who are losing their sight. But how about looking at people before they lose their sight?
Yeah.
Talking about engaging in primary care services and then the treatment of long-term conditions on the other end. So yes, you have a condition. How can I help you to understand how to manage that condition and stabilize that condition by the use of medication or other things? But provide that understanding. So my work tends to spread across the three platforms: the acute care, the preventative side, and then the long-term management side. So it's super interesting, super excited, to do it every day, really.
And so from that PhD, you're successful, you have your PhD, you found your passion. Were
Yes.
you able to quickly and successfully move into a postdoctoral career? Did you get a fellowship quickly? How what sort of pushed you on after the PhD?
Yeah, so no, I didn't go on a meteoric rise. I went back to being a Band 6 nurse, Band 6 research nurse, as most of us do. And then within a year or so, I got a small grant and moved on to Band 7 and did a nurse fellow research role for a bit. And then there was an opening in my unit for the head of research nursing. So I applied for that job in 2015 and got it. And little did I know, I was pregnant at the time. So within 6 months of getting the role, I was off on maternity leave. So that was very interesting. I came back, did that for 5 years, but I was still always interested in pursuing academia and moving on. So again, comes another segue in my career. Applying for grants and couldn't get any. And then I had some really big names on the application forms and I still couldn't get it. So I went and spoke to a professor that I respected to say, okay, have a look at my application. Please give me some tips. What can I do? And he said, Roxanne, there's nothing wrong with your application. He said, however, at this point in time, you're the wrong color and the wrong gender to succeed. And I was very appreciative for that comment. So, I mean, some of our listeners will be aghast that that was said. But I took it as in, you know what? At least I know what other people's barriers are, not my barriers, other people's barriers. So, what can I do to overcome it and also improve myself in the time being? So, I was quite fortunate to be referred to Professor Leon Aitken at City University, and Professor Julie Sanders. And then over the next 6 months, they became my mentors, building me up from where I was and my self-esteem after that comment. And then, quickly got me onto a Florence Nightingale Fellowship. Then I went, and then I did, from that, I did 4 fellowships in 2 years. I was on a drive to, be the best that I can be. So I got Florence Nightingale Fellowship, developed a program online, did some qualitative research, did a Topol Digital Health Fellowship, looking at, digitally enabling our staff for the future, went on and got the 70, NIHR 70 at 70 Research Leaders Program, and then finally got the NIHR Clinical Lectureship as it was at the time in 2020. And all of those experiences, going to Yale as a Florence Nightingale scholar, being a visiting scholar there, all of those experiences helped me to become the person that I am now.
Yeah, and it is the knocks, isn't it? It's the
Yes.
knocks sometimes as much as the successes. It's the sometimes it's the lack of success that is the biggest driver. It's the one that
Yes.
motivates you most.
Yeah, and it was, I think about what he said up till now, and I shouldn't be grateful for him, but I was grateful because I had blinkers on. Again, those blinkers, as in, you're within your own space and within your own world and not realizing what else can be out there. So I always say to my mentees now, your own limitation is the one you put upon yourself. You should never allow anybody to determine your self-worth. And here I had fallen into that same trap. So what did I need to get to do to get out of it? So, it was hard work those 2 years, but it was completely and utterly worth it.
And from your perspective, we're probably talking 10 years ago when you were given that message.
No,
Have
that was
things
2018.
not even not even that long ago. So it might not, it probably doesn't lead to the next question in the same way that I thought it did, but have things changed? Are things improving? Do you feel that that's still the message to people?
Yes, it unfortunately things haven't changed. It's gone a bit more underground, but staff from a global majority population are still receiving those messages, sometimes overtly, but most times covertly. So it's all about how do we get them to identify that these things are going on. But even if they can't identify it, build themselves up. So I have the great fortune to teach on Professor Calvin Morley's inter-research program for Black and Brown researchers and the work that he's doing for midwives with Elevate. And it's all about taking those budding researchers, those budding healthcare professionals who would have experienced something similar to what I did, and realizing the problem isn't you. You're working in a broken system. So how do we navigate that system, and how do we build you and your self-esteem? Because your patients need you, your family needs you, and we don't want you to be broken at the end of this process.
It sounds like wonderful work, and obviously we've had Kelvin on as a guest, so we know his passion and his background. Has that shaped your research, that way of thinking? Is it as important to you as the ophthalmology has it become almost running parallel with what you do now?
I think it's running parallel and it's all merged because not just the staff, but now I've realized, oh, I always knew, but it came to the fore that also our patients are not having a raw deal. So their treatment outcomes are worse. And it stems from a lack of knowledge, them not knowing how to navigate the NHS and the system, not knowing what services are available to them, having different beliefs. I'm not going to say wrong beliefs, just different beliefs, but is how do we work with them and their communities to understand, okay, this is what you believe. This is, we usually do faith communities. This is what the Bible says. This is what the Quran says. How do we merge those two to move together? And you look after your faith, and then you look out, and then I can help you look after your health. Speaking to leaders in those communities. So is it the imam? Is it the preacher or the pastor? And working with, so it's morphed into, one big piece of work. And it's again all about the family, the person, the family, and their communities, and spreading the message out there. So now my piece of work is promoting eye health and research in underserved communities. Because but as a researcher, I want to get them in. But that's not their priority to come in for research. What they want is information about eye health. So how do I merge my both passions to give them what they want, and then I get what I want in terms of data to help them as well?
That makes absolute sense. And what we do with this podcast is always say from a sort of episode notes perspective, do share your work. So if there's anything we can do to help you share both of those messages, the one around the clinical side, the ophthalmology, and the one about representation and about improving, the way the system works, then do share those with us, and we'll put those in the episode notes, because that'd be really valuable
Thank
for
you.
everyone, I think, particularly the listeners. The next thing for me really is I suppose I'm listening to you thinking, well, when we become leaders in research, we want to be role models, but you've had to be a role model on so many different levels. That's quite clear listening to you. So how does that sit with you, having to be a role model? Because you're probably going to have to be a role model from a sense of sort of of your background. You've said your color of skin, probably as a woman in research and as a nurse. So is it a heavy crown to wear?
I wouldn't say it's a crown because I don't see it as that. I just see it more as me helping my colleagues, helping my mentees, helping people around me. And that's what we do as nurses anyway. You share the joy, you share the love, you share the sorrows. How can I help you be better? And then if you are better, if you're enjoying your work, if you are having periods of success as well, then our patients, who we do care about as, core central nurses, would also benefit. So it goes hand in hand. And I like the word role model, but it tends to show a hierarchy, and I'm quite flat about the way I lead and I, manage. We're all a team. We all work together. We are all able to, fit into different pieces of the jigsaw. My knows that my thought pattern is never linear. It's more like a spider's web. It always comes back to the center at some point, but they've learned how to deal with that. And then they can pick up where I let the ball drop, and then vice versa. And it's just teamwork. A teamwork makes the dream work. And I could not do without my colleagues and my team. And everywhere I go, I always celebrate them. And I'm always happy to have more people come on board. But they are so vitally important to everything that I do.
I what I meant to say was, is it a heavy burden to bear? And I think
No.
because I because for some reason I got crown in my head. I think crown to wear, that's completely a wrong statement, isn't it? Although a crown would suit you, Roxanne, you'd be absolutely fine in a
Thank
crown.
you very much.
But it doesn't have to be a burden, does it? Because all you're trying to be is yourself.
Yes.
That's the crucial side of it. So leadership has sort of became a big part of your role, and that's happened very quickly. So did I hear right that you got one of the 70 awards?
Yes, I was one of
How
the
did that come
initial.
about?
Again, it was my drive to improve myself, and that was the third in this series of the 2 year gap of awards. Okay, what can I do? This program came up. I happened to be the senior researcher, as from a nurse perspective within my trust, and I thought, okay, fine. That 2 days a week for 3 years is going to give me the opportunity to create a platform that I want to use to help more people know about what research we do at Moorfields and about in eyes in general. So we created the me and my colleagues created a Roam platform, research opportunities at Moorfields, and that platform won the Nursing Time Awards in 2021. And since then we've with it, just talking about Roam and talking about eye health and research more recently, we and then translating it again into English and Hindi and different languages, we had over 42 million listeners just from one radio broadcast. So it's always been a part of that journey, but that 2 days a week helped me to build capacity within the trust and also to spread the message about research and the importance of eye research.
Yeah, that's incredible. And thinking, and I'm just thinking out of the box now, ref and impact and things. Wow, look at those metrics that you've got there. People would give anything to have that many people listening to the message and their research, wouldn't they? But I'm going to slightly skip to the point of it's important to get this message across now that you were a 70 at 70 nurse, which was a nurse leader. And that program has now been called the Senior Research Leadership Program for the NIHR.
Yes.
I have the great pleasure, and I'm very proud to be one of cohort two of that. So I'm delighted to be on board. But you are now the lead for that. So tell us about your role there and how that came about.
Yeah, so the Senior Research Leader Program builds on the success of the 70 at 70 program, and we really want to realize the untapped potential of our senior nurses and midwives. We have lots of people in this space who are leading research capacity and capability building. How can we, as an NIHR, empower them to further increase this capacity building and also to support their own development as future leaders? And how did I get this post? So we always talk about tapping on the shoulder. And the lovely Associate Director of Nursing, right, Jen Allison, gave me a friendly tap on the shoulder when this interim post came out to advert. And even at this stage, I looked at the advert and I thought, that's a nice post. I really love that post, but oh, it's not for me. And I didn't even open the application form. And then Jen found me at the Nursing Time Awards last year, around October. And she's like, "Are you applying?" "Oh, no, Jen, I can't possibly do it." And she's like, "No, you are applying." And she took my number and she sent me a text message every single day until I did apply. So we all need that friendly ally, that push. And fortunately, I got the post, and I'm so thrilled to be the interim lead for this program. I absolutely love the team atmosphere and the camaraderie I have with all 59 of the SRLs.
Yeah, that's superb. And yeah, like I say, I'm delighted. It's the early stages of cohort two, but delighted to be part of it. And I think we can share some news that we've agreed that the Nurse Researcher podcast will do a special series for the
Yes,
NIHR for the senior
definitely.
research leaders. And you're gonna signpost me to five specific members of the cohort. And we're going to do a special series just asking about their roles again, a little bit how they got to where they are and what they're looking to do as senior research leaders.
Yes, and I'm so looking forward to it.
And I startled you and surprised you by saying you will have to summarize the episodes with me. So you're going to have to be doing a little bit more podcasting.
Yes, you did. And I agreed. But anything to showcase my colleagues, I'm up for
I thought you were going to say anything to shut me up then. It's been said before.
it.
But it's, and I think the cherry on the cake for me with this episode, because it's such a positive story and such a great career trajectory, is that I think we can now openly say congratulations. Is it now Professor Roxanne?
Yes, as of October, it will be definitely official. I'll be able to change the title. But yes, UCL has awarded me a professorship. And thank you very much to them for recognizing the work and the contribution I've made to the field.
Well, I think it's not just to the field, as it's to the profession, you know, it's to different cultures. It spans so many things what you've done that it does feel very, very timely to do this, and it's a real achievement for yourself. And I think we don't say this to nurses enough, but you are a credit to yourself, you know, as much as your mum, you know, and that history that you've got and the family that you talk about, you've trod new ground and you've trailblazed with this, and it's a wonderful story. I think that they'll probably have to sell tickets for your inaugural.
Thank you. But you know, I couldn't possibly be here without standing on the shoulders of giants. So even though currently I'm the only professor of ophthalmic nursing in the country, there was Professor Janet Marsden before me, who was an absolute trailblazer, and she was also the chair of the Irish and Ophthalmic Forum, which I was also a member. And then Professor Heather Waterman, and these two ladies have done so much work for ophthalmic nursing. And I'm just so pleased to be among, you know, such esteemed colleagues and standing on shoulders of giants. That is exactly what I have done. Yeah, it's a brilliant achievement for all. And yes, I should be more forthcoming about my own achievement, but you know, we as nurses tend to not want to shine our light that much. But yes, I do acknowledge, and thank you very much for saying so.
No, absolutely. I think there's nobody listening that would disagree. It's a wonderful story. I always ask this question in regards to people's careers and stories, but if you had your time again, from a research perspective, would you do anything differently?
No, thinking about it, I think I've always given myself time to reflect and to think about where exactly what I wanted to do, where I wanted to go. I've always availed myself of every opportunity. As you can tell, doing four fellowships in 2 years is absolute madness, but I did it. I wouldn't do anything differently, and I think I'd advise people coming up, just literally make yourself available of all opportunities. Get as much training as you can so that when opportunities do come on board, you're able to you know to take them up.
Yeah.
But yeah, I wouldn't change my trajectory, I wouldn't change my patients, I wouldn't change my experiences because they've definitely shaped who I am.
Yeah, that's fabulous. And that you won't be surprised to hear that a lot of our nurse academics are saying that, a lot of nurse researchers are saying no, actually, because I think like you, what they've recognized is even when they've had the knockbacks, that's made them stronger.
Yes.
So I don't think, you know, a clear
a clear pathway to where they've got to would have made them the person they are today. So it's, I think we're getting more of that, that people say, no, actually, I wouldn't change this. This has been how it's been for me, and it's worked right. So final question, what now?
Yes.
What aspirations do you have? What do you hope to do as chair? What's your next driver? Or is it the continued thing and to sort of improve, you know, the systems and the way things are working in the UK with nursing and research?
Yeah, so what I haven't said is that even though I'm doing ophthalmology, I've also been dabbling in the digital space. So working with Professor Natasha Phillips, who was the previous Chief Nursing Information Officer for England. I've also been working with the likes of Professor Pierce Keane, who is an AI guru here at Moorfields. So I keep putting my fingers into lots of different pies, and they tend to be quite fruitful. So I'm going to continue to do that. I'm going to continue to hopefully be a mentor and a friend to all those who require me to be, and keep building that capacity and capability within the research and within the nursing workforce and anybody else who wants to come on board. But I'm quite invested in the senior research leaders. I know probably calling them my senior research leaders is making it too personal and a big ownership, but so invested in their leadership skills and they being the leaders that they need to be in their different areas across the country, because it's only through them can we get other nurses interested in research and making research matter down to the shop floor, down to the root. You know, I call it tentacles. The more tentacles we have with the 70 at 70 alumni and the, you know, upcoming cohorts of senior research leaders and the current cohorts, is the more we can hope to make research actually embedded into clinical practice. And we know that research underpins everything that we do. So it, you know, it's a vested interest. And once we're able to do that, then we're able to say, okay, we are actually giving evidence-informed and evidence-based care. So yes, it's a long, circuitous way of doing it, but at the end of the day, our patients are going to benefit from it.
Roxanne, what a perfect end. What a wonderful message and a great episode. So Dr. Roxanne Crosby-Nwobi, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
Much appreciated. Thank you. Hello and welcome back to the Nurse Researcher podcast and our summary section, as ever, with Eleanor Hovard. And Eleanor, I don't really know where to start with this. This was an amazing episode that almost, I feel like it deserves its own podcast for the summary, really. It's we both know Roxanne in different ways, and I've met her a number of times over the last couple of years. But like all of our episodes, you unpick new things from people and learn all about them in a different way. And just what a fabulous story this one is.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in my eyes, Roxanne, she really is a star, and she made me feel really proud to be a nurse. You know, she's super intelligent, compassionate, and I could really feel that fire in her belly that's driving her to make a difference, you know, and just in so many different ways. So, you know, you're right. She really is an inspiration. And I really enjoyed listening to Roxanne's story. She, you know, I could really picture her there from a young age as well, helping her mum ferry that water back and forth that she described, getting that hands-on experience, you know, from such a young age as well.
Yeah.
And interesting about the book as well that she mentioned that her mum suggested to her, you know, having wanted to be a neurosurgeon to begin with, thinking big, unleashing your potential. And she's done that, hasn't she?
What books did you get when you were 10?
Oh, Andrew, that's such a tough question. Oh, my goodness.
I know what I will have gotten. Mine will have been a Shute annual or a Grange Hill annual. It certainly won't have been neurosurgery.
Oh, well, that's funny. Yeah, I mean, I grew up in the States. I used to love the Babysitter's Club books, the whole series. But I did actually, funny enough, and this isn't about me, but I actually really enjoyed reading about health. And I used to go through, my mum had a medical book and I used to look through it. And I also, there was this thing, there was, you know how sometimes like petrol stations do like these offers where you can get a folder and you can collect things. Well, there was one on offer about healthcare problems and things like that. And I used to love collecting those. So I guess, you know, I was interested as well from a young age. But anyway, this is about Roxanne.
But I mean, that was the first thing I thought when I listened back to it. I always listen back to the episodes to try and think about the things I want to pull out for the summary. And there are probably some some things that are more difficult to talk about that we'll pick out with this summary, but as a positive start, I mean, I think the mum as a role model was fantastic, and talking about the things like having to do histograms and make sure that you'd done things right. And the mum was very much culturally was fantastic, wasn't it? You know, I'm doing this for you, therefore you need to do this for me. And it was just great. And I thought, I know she didn't particularly like the term role model for herself, but I think because she talked about hierarchy, but there is a hierarchy with your mum and mum and daughter. And I think that was lovely to hear about, you know, what her mum had sort of guided her to do, the inspiration she got from that first book, and the sense of knowing what she wanted to be. But she was equally, you just got the sense that she was so determined and independent as a child as well, because that decision that actually, you know, I wanted to go to medicine, but that's too much for my mum and dad, you know, and I don't want to do that. So actually the determination to go, no, actually, I'm looking elsewhere originally, I thought was an unbelievable story to tell.
It was, absolutely. And I think, you know, she just shows that she absolutely smashed it and was going to make the most of, you know, what she could. And you're right, you know, the way she described being a role model as indicating a hierarchy, I think that's a really important point that she made. And Roxanne's so humble, I think, and that really came through, you know, whatever point you are at in your career, you know, we can all learn from each other. And yes, there are people that inspire us. Really refreshing sort of leadership approach that she has. So, you know, I loved hearing about her story and her clear passion for healthcare as well. But interesting, as well, she said her parents didn't have those aspirations. They just said, be the best you can be.
Yeah.
That's really important as well, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a life lesson, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure, for sure. I mean, I did find this interview with Roxanne particularly interesting because, as you know, my PhD is around understanding inclusion and participation of Black people in health and care research. So quite a bit of what Roxanne was saying in her experiences was quite meaningful to me in the space in which I'm working. So, for example, she spoke about the first placement that she had in gynecology, but then also went on to talk about her experience of having a mentor. And when she was, you know, she was told by this mentor that because her name was Roxanne Crosby, that she thought that was a white Liverpool name. And then she goes on to talk about the mentor saying about the name of a bank nurse, an African nurse, and saying that this nurse can't be any, can she? And that experience really stayed with Roxanne. And of course, you know, it's a racist comment. And that shaped Roxanne. It shaped her research. It shaped how she interacts with people, she said. And she said she didn't feel welcomed. And it makes environments really uncomfortable. It feels unsafe for some of our colleagues. And to be honest, it creates that toxic culture, doesn't it, that still exists. And, you know, we only have to refer to the NMC report that was just published, that what Roxanne experienced, and undoubtedly so many more of our colleagues from Black and global majority populations have also heard, you know, and experienced these examples of racial discrimination and microaggressions that, you know, demean a person's race. And nor I nor you know what that's like to experience racism, do we? We don't have the lived experience of being Black or from a global majority, but these experiences are shaping our colleagues' lives, like Roxanne, and they can be very harmful, you know, in so many ways. And, you know, she even then said, whilst, you know, she didn't let this stop her in any way or means, did she? But again, when she was applying for grants at that postdoctoral level, the comment about the application that she just couldn't, you know, when she had some big names on applications, but she just couldn't get the grants. And then she was told that it was because she was the wrong color and the wrong gender to succeed. But she was appreciative of that comment. However, you know, what does that say? You know, and when you asked her, you know, is that still the way things are right now? And yes, she said, you know, things are still, that is still happening. And she described that as being quite underground, you know, covert. And I took that to mean, you know, that this institutional racism is here. It's still there, isn't it? It's just perhaps, and that's the whole thing. It's quite invisible at times. But it's unjust, and, you know, and mindsets need to be challenged and changed. And it's so harmful for our Black colleagues that have to face this. However, you know, Roxanne has she's blown through all of that, hasn't she? And you know, the drive that she had to undertake those four fellowships in 2 years, do a program online, the Digital Health Scholarship, the NIHR 70 at 70. I was like, oh my gosh, oh, no. You know, she absolutely went for it, didn't she? And what an inspiration.
It's such an amazing story. I mean, and I think, and sorry, Alan, I'll try and cut across you there. That I'm learning, and I hope that some of the listeners are like me, learning to recognize this a little bit more. There's, you know, nobody in my shoes in a profession like we're in, I don't expect this. And but equally don't recognize that it's there. So there's probably been it amongst people like myself over the years. There's an involuntary ignorance. You're not trying to be ignorant of these things, but you're just not there recognizing it. And I've learned a great deal about this from some of the interviews we've done, you know, great interviews with Calvin Morley, with Gina Owoko Higginbottom, more recently with Oladeo, that the message is pretty clear that actually things aren't changing quick enough, if they're changing at all. And that's quite frightening to hear, isn't it?
It is. It is. It's much harder for our colleagues from Black and global majority populations, especially if you want to develop a clinical academic career or an academic career, or even progress in your career. Mm. And so each of us, you know, we have that duty and that responsibility to identify and challenge and oppose racism. Yeah. It's not good enough, is it? Just saying you're not going to be racist. We've actually got to identify it. And also look at ourselves. Like you say, this is a really good opportunity in some ways to share that, you know, that we need to be critically reflecting on ourselves and our own behaviors and unfounded beliefs, and, you know, how these can be damaging to our colleagues and also our patients in our care.
Yeah. And it makes me think about as well, recognizing this in far more junior people in nursing, you know, thinking about the journey of the student nurse that might be experiencing these sorts of things very early stages of their careers, because what you don't want to do is this to end careers early in the training and to put people off the profession. That we want to be people to be very really proud and really well mentored and supported in the roles of student nurses. And you know, so With Roxanne, she's had to sort of keep climbing over these barriers, and she's been a real sort of, you know, she is now a real, and I know, again, I want to say role model, whether she thinks that's hierarchical or not, but some people will never get to that stage because they're going to get knocked too soon and just leave the profession. And I felt so sorry for it. So she's so positive, you know, and so bubbly and so open about these things, but you know, there was even a time when I think it was a Black female patient threw a slipper at her, you know, and you think she couldn't, she was damned if she did, damned if she didn't, a little bit, wasn't she? And I know these are isolated incidents, particularly the patient one, but these will be things that stay with her, won't they? These will be things that stay in the memory, and these shouldn't be the highlights of your career, should they? They shouldn't be the things that come to the forefront when you're talking about your career. These should be the things that actually, you know, nobody should have to experience.
No, that's right. And of course, those things are an outcome, you know, of the systemic racism that has existed and how embedded it is within society. But like you say, you know, it's important that there are good mentors out there for all of our colleagues and, you know, people just entering the profession of nursing midwifery and for those that also want to develop their career and helping them to progress, because it is more difficult, you know, their career progression is hindered a lot of the time because of the color of their skin, you know, and Roxanne explained that to us in this interview as well. However, you know, it was interesting as well, though, listening to her expectations around the PhD when you asked her about that, and she said she didn't have any expectations. But also I found it really interesting how she went from being trained as a gynae nurse and then she ended up doing her PhD in ophthalmology, and how amazing that has gone from her interest in wanting to be a neurosurgeon and then, you know, to studying diabetic eye disease and that relationship to the brain. It's like come full circle. And you could just sense the passion she has about eyes, couldn't you? The architecture of the eyes. You know, she loves her clinical work as well.
The window really to the soul, I think she said at one point, the window to the soul. And you think, you know, it's fabulous now. And when you're talking about things like early detection of dementia and things like that, that we learn. I mean, we're learning so much. I listened to a lecture by somebody from the Zoe app recently. We're learning so much about gut health, you know, and we're learning so much now about things through ophthalmology, that sometimes when you're in the moment and when this is your, you know, this is your time, you think, well, how can we go any further than we are now? You know, how can we increase the evidence base in what we do? But we're learning all the time, aren't we? And people are right on the cusp of huge changes in health. And she's there with ophthalmology, isn't she?
Yeah, I mean, it's groundbreaking work that she was undertaking, isn't it? And this is what I mean when I was saying, you know, she for me is like the epitome of what you can be as a nurse and a nurse researcher, you know, doing this groundbreaking research. But she's got a finger in so many pies, but all of them tend to be quite fruitful. But she is multitasking and juggling so many different things, but all for the benefit of improving. You know, that really comes across. This is about improving patient outcomes as well for her, but also improving her colleagues' outcomes and opportunities as well. And I loved the tips that she gave as well. And you know, when you asked her what top tips would you have, and she said that she is a real reflector, really thinks about things and has taken opportunities when she's had them. How important it is to also then make yourself available for those opportunities and just to get you know, as much training as you can.
And the trajectory was very quick, wasn't it? I mean, particularly master's and PhD.
Yeah.
I mean, she didn't give herself much of a break before she got back on the horse with that one. But like most people, and I think, again, that is useful to hear for people, you know, when people are listening, thinking it's a real struggle to get postdoc opportunities and get postdoc funding. She did struggle with that, but finding that Florence Nightingale Foundation and being able to push on from there, that she just kept going, found her lane as such from an ophthalmology point of view and the specialism, and really developed the career around that. But there was so much that you could highlight that it was difficult to pull it all out. I don't think we really identified that she'd been, you know, the Nursing Times Nurse of the Year. I don't think that really came out, but she has, you know, the going from being really developing leadership in 70 at 70 to then in its new guise as senior research leaders. She's now the interim program lead for that. And then the real cherry on the cake for the interview was the fact that she, you know, it's just been announced that she has a chair and she'll be taking the title of professor from, I think she said October. And there's never been a more fitting title, has this? I mean, she really is at the top of her game, but the top of her game was so much more to do and offer.
Absolutely. She's achieved so much. You're right. And all of those awards and the recognition that she has received, perhaps because she's so humble, you know, didn't come out in the interview, but you only have to, you know, look over social media to see how much she has achieved and how much ambition, you know, she's had. And the persistence that she's had to have, you know, to get to this point as well. Yeah. It's lovely, you know, really lovely to hear from her and hear her story.
And she is incredibly humble. She won't appreciate me saying she was a little bit nervous before the interview. So that's a good thing to hear from people, you know, in senior roles. It makes everybody else feel, oh, that's okay. Because I think she just wanted to get the story right and get the message across that she wanted to share. So, and it was a great interview, and it could have gone on and on and on, really. And one of these days, I think we're going to need a two-parter, aren't we, with people. But it's, you know, with me as the interviewer, I'm pulling on people's time, and I never feel I can say, you know, could we make this two parts? Because you don't really know where you're going to go until you start the interview. But we're getting close, I think, to the first two-parter, and this was one where I felt like saying, actually, we could end this here and make this part one and do a part two. But there's no saying we can't bring these people back.
Of course. No, I'd love to hear more as well from Roxanne. But, you know, like you said in the podcast as well, that you and Roxanne are going to be doing a special series as well, the senior research leader. So that's something really exciting as well that's on the cards, and I can't wait to hear that. So we will be hearing more from Roxanne in the future as well.
It gives you a little break gives you a little break. Probably an appropriate time in your PhD to give you a little
I
break
appreciate
before we pull
that.
You
Thank
back
you.
in. And that, so it probably does give you a little bit of a break from having to do these summaries and having to listen through. But yes, she was very, she was very good at saying, would you be interested in doing this? And what could it be part of the podcast when we discuss this? So I think Roxanne's going to select five particular people from the Senior Research Leadership Programme. And we'll do an interview with them about what their role entails and what they're doing with that title. So that'll
really
be a nice, very specific five episodes.
It'll be something different to hear about, won't it?
Yeah, but looking forward to doing that.
Fantastic interview. And I think, you know, Roxanne just sets the bar so high, doesn't she, for aspiring nurse researchers. And I just love that. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, she does, and it's probably it's probably important to point out in this and from this episode, Eleanor, and from, you know, we don't normally put a timestamp on these episodes because what we don't want to be doing is talking about snow outside if we put an episode out in the middle of the summer, but this episode is going to be probably very close to the NMC report,
mm-hmm.
which has shone a very poor light onto what's been happening and what the culture is. So if this episode has caused anybody distress or has caused any problems or if it does, if it does bring things out in people that perhaps they hadn't expected, there is a hotline, isn't there, Eleanor, that we can probably signpost to in the NMC?
There is, absolutely. I think we acknowledge that racism exists in health and care and in research, and the impact on our colleagues can be devastating. So the NMC have shared a separate care line on their website. So that number is 03003033731. And I understand that service is available 24 hours a day, 365 days a year.
Yeah. And I think important that we say that, because what we don't want to do is cause any unnecessary distress in everybody that's listening to these episodes based on, you know, prior experiences of the interviewee or of their own.
No, I think it's important equally that, you know, we have these open discussions as well. So
great episode, some really important messages there, and hopefully, again, shining a light on some of the negatives that people can experience in their careers in the right way, in a way of trying to sort to dig that out and trying to eradicate it in future, well, all aspects of our discipline in healthcare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Lovely, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Eleanor.
Take care. Bye.